Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com. On this week's program, Ellen takes a quick look at some of the momentous monetary issues that accompanied the closing parts of 2014, and she talks with author Les Leopold, who holds a crystal clear view of what's happened to our democratic economics since the rise of the financialists in the early 1980s. Later in the program, we'll talk with attorney and activist Kevin Zeis about the impending D.C. push to get the TPP agreement onto fast track and the need to prepare for action to try to stop it. But now, here's Ellen.
Thanks, Walt. Well, 2014 has been an interesting year, and 2015 bodes to be an even more interesting one in the sense of the old Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. It seems the U.S. has managed to get into another Cold War with Russia. So far, it's largely economic, but the fear is that it will turn into a hot nuclear war, which would be terrible. It's supposedly over Ukraine, but some pundits say that it's actually part of a neocon power play to get Russia, and more specifically to get Russia and China. But what it seems to be doing is to be driving Russia and China into the arms of each other. So all those developments will be very interesting to watch. Maybe as part of that Cold War, the price of oil dropped by 50% in the fall of 2014, to virtually everyone's surprise, except perhaps the Saudis and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, who are rumored to have negotiated the plunge, again, arguably, as part of this Get Russia plan. Who it riled up in the U.S., apparently, was the big derivatives banks, who have a lot of wagers placed on the price of oil, and this was totally outside the parameters of their computer models. That could explain why Jamie Dimon threw his weight in on the omnibus budget bill in December in order to push for it to be passed. It seems there was a provision slipped into the bill that repealed a portion of the Dodd-Frank Act that said that depository banks cannot do certain risky forms of derivatives bets for its own account in a bank that is a depository bank. Of course, as we know, once you put your money in the bank, it belongs to the banks, and then whatever they do with it, all their responsibility is to just give your money back. But if they go bankrupt, then that's your problem, but at least you're covered by the FDIC, but not if a depository bank is not allowed to do that. Then your recourse is with the FDIC, but that's only if they were gambling in a bank that is a depository bank. I've written an article on that, which is on my blog, ellenbrown.com, if you want more data on it. Meanwhile, in the last few days, attentions have turned to Greece, which has boldly, the Greek lawmakers have defied the bureaucrats and failed to elect the presidential candidate that would have pushed for more austerity in order to make sure that the Greeks pay off their very onerous debts. So what that does is it opens up the presidency to a general election, which means that the candidate who is currently winning in the polls, the austerity anti-bailout candidate, could well win. Interestingly, before the election, there was a directive put out by Goldman Sachs, which was posted by on Zero Hedge, that said, basically, don't try it, because what you're risking is that you'll be cut off from your lifeline with the ECB, the European Central Bank. Of course, all banks are technically insolvent. They all make loans to money they don't have, and so they depend on borrowing. They depend on these lines of liquidity. They can borrow from other banks, or the ultimate backstop is the central bank, because the central bank can print money as needed. But if that liquidity is cut off, then they can go bankrupt. Well, the Greeks called their bluff and went ahead and did what they were warned not to do. So it looks like the Greeks are holding the better cards in this case, because it's unlikely that the ECB and the IMF actually would let Greece default, because then they would probably withdraw from the Eurozone, and it could actually mean the end of the EU, possibly. So that, too, will be something very interesting to watch for next year. Meanwhile, in the U.S., it was predicted by some pundits that this was the year that the stock market was going to collapse, but it didn't. In fact, it boomed. And so that's a bit puzzling, considering that consumer incomes are down, consumer credit is down, and retail sales are not doing so well either. So what's up with that? Our first guest today has some very interesting insights on that question. Les Leopold is the director of the Labor Institute and an avid writer of articles, which can be found on Alternet and Truthout and Huffington Post, among other places. His most recent book is called How to Make $1 Million an Hour, Why Hedge Funds Get Away with Siphoning Off America's Wealth. He is currently working on a book focusing on why the richest country on earth is so poor. Great to talk to you, Les.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I was just giving a little rundown of 2014 and remarking that the stock market was booming, although the economy itself is languishing, at least from the perspective of the 99%. So you have an interesting explanation for why that is, having to do with the change in the fundamental structure of the modern corporation precipitated by financialization. Can you explain that?
Sure. Something unbelievably major happened to our economy and to the corporation in the late 70s, 1980 or so. On the policy level, we adopted what we call the Better Business Climate Model, where you cut taxes on the wealthy and corporations, you remove regulations on business, and you cut back on government services. And this is supposed to lead to an investment boom, which in turn is going to have all boats will rise as a result of this. Well, if you look at all the data that we now have, you can see that runaway inequality starts almost exactly when this policy comes in 1980, and so do a lot of other pernicious trends in the U.S. economy. But the way that happens is can be seen best by looking at the corporation itself. As a result of deregulation, we call them raiders, corporate raiders at that point, now they're hedge funds, private equity companies, investment banks, bought up corporations. And they once things were nice and deregulated, they changed the nature of the way the corporation worked. It used to be that the corporation was designed to on retaining earnings and reinvesting them, retain and reinvest. And it reinvested them in many things, but one of the most important things was they reinvested in their own employees, providing more training, providing wage increases, so that they could retain this body of knowledge in the corporation. Well, when the Raiders came along, they said, nope, that's not the way we're going to do it. We want as much profit as we can, as fast as we can. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to cut back the workforce, ship products overseas, and extract as much wealth as we can from the corporation. And they did an incredibly good job at this. Those who remember the period, there was a tremendous disinvestment. Old plants were shut down right and left. Products were outsourced. The whole idea of investing in workers was thrown out the window. The new way was cut back, get rid of the union, go into bankruptcy, cut back as many benefits as you possibly could, and stop investing in the workforce and extract as much wealth as you can. they also changed the way in which corporate executives were paid. Corporate executives became part of the new management, financial management team, and this is what financialism actually means. They became part of the team, and they were given stock options as for most of their pay. So the idea was to drive up the value of the stock as fast as you could, and that would enrich not just the investors, the raiders, the private equity companies, the banks, et cetera, but also it would enrich the CEOs. Now, the real trick of this was what you want to do is you want to load up the company with as much debt as you can. When they purchased the company, they didn't use much of their own money. They used debt. And then the company, it's like you buy a home and then you stick the mortgage with somebody else. They stuck the mortgage with the company. And then they took out even more loans so that they could buy back their own stock. And if you buy back your own stock, by definition, it makes the remaining stock more valuable. And that can drive up the shares of the stock, and that in turn enrich the CEOs. And at that point, you see this incredible gap between the CEOs and the average workers. It goes from about 20 to 1 in the 1960s to now, 350, 400 to 1 as a result of this financialization process. All of this is kind of hidden from view, but it's really changed the nature of what our economy is about. And actually, to speak of a unified economy now is kind of a joke. I mean, because it operates extremely well when someone says, well, look, the papers say, well, we had 5% GDP growth this last quarter. Fantastic. Wages have been absolutely stagnant. And what's happened is the money has gone to the top 1%, the top fraction of the 1%. That's what they're using the same methods to drive up the stocks, the value of the stock, and they're holding down workers' wages as much as possible. Unions have gotten smaller, and the regulations are very weak, and financiers of all types are able to grab up a company and then basically extract wealth from the company as opposed to reinvesting it in the company.
Wow, that's horrible. You have a great phrase in a different article that was called The Financial Strip Mining of America. You have some really great images. I saw that in University of California system, that there were people complaining about being financialized in the sense that the board of directors had all these financial people on it that were the ones that had made these various forms of bad investments. I mean, things that turned out to be bad investments for the University of California system, the interest rate swaps that they shouldn't have entered into. These are people on the board or people that are actually working right there with the executives. So I assume that's the same thing. And that's a public entity, which has totally been taken over by Wall Street pretty much.
Well, financial strip mining takes place at every level. State and local governments are strip mined through those interest rate swaps, but all kinds of financial deals are set up that are just bad for the taxpayer and bad for the local government. And then, of course, the local government gets blamed, and the investor says, well, they were sophisticated. The investment banks say, it wasn't our fault. They were sophisticated. They knew what they were getting into. And this happens again and again and again. And it happens because, as there is only one public bank in the country. And if every state had a public bank, you wouldn't see state and local government have to go to Wall Street every time they need to finance. The other side of this is tax revenues are not what they should be because through Wall Street, the wealthy have trillions of dollars parked abroad where they are immune from American taxes. And these loopholes are designed into the tax system, of course, by the wealthy lobbyists, and they just go on and on and on. So the rest of us have to pick up the tab, and we can't take it anymore, so that we start revolting against the tax increases, the public services collapse, the state and local governments then have to go to Wall Street for more financing, and the cycle just goes on and on and on. So we have a boom, we have a stock market boom that impacts only a very few, a handful of people when we look at our country as a whole, are getting what did we look at? The top 1% has gotten 95% of the growth since the crash of 2008. 95% has gone to the top 1%, and the rest of us basically are sharing 5% of the growth, if that.
Terrible. One of your other titles that I thought was really great was in March 2013, and it was called "Why Is Socialism Doing So Darn Well in Deep Red, North Dakota?" I wish I could think of titles like that. So, do you want to explain that?
This I learned from you.
I know.
No, seriously, I ran into a friend of mine who knew about you, the Public Banking Institute, and I met you, and I started to become a little more educated. I'm not in your league about how the banking system really works, and I did a little research on the Bank of North Dakota. First of all, what's great about the Bank of North Dakota, it directly comes from the last time the American people really challenged Wall Street, and that was through the populist movement, which started after the Civil War and picked up steam into the 1880s and 1890s and then turned into kind of the progressive movement of the early 20th century, out of which we got some banking reform, some antitrust legislation, and we started to get the beginnings of wage and hour laws, laws against child labor, those kinds of things. And in 1919, a kind of populist progressive formation in North Dakota, the Midwestern states were very populist oriented. They instituted a new bank, a public bank, because they were tired of basically being at the mercy of the large banks in Minneapolis, Chicago, and New York, which were the big cities that they had to deal with. And they wanted to get some control over the resources they need to build the state. Well, now the bank is remarkable in several ways. First of all, it didn't lose any money during the crash because it didn't invest in the funny, the phony securities like the CDOs and the credit default swaps and all the alphabet soup that we learned about. They didn't invest in risky mortgages. They didn't do any of that. They were just a basic bank, what used to be what we used to view as a kind of community bank, but they were a wholesale bank at the state level, and they supported 80 community banks. That was one thing that caught my eye. The other thing that caught my eye was the average pay of the top four executives of that bank was something like $110,000. I mean, I called them up. It's public record. That's less than, a Wall Street banker's cook earns or a Wall Street banker's chauffeur. And they seem to be doing an excellent job. So the idea that you have to make $100 million a year to run a successful bank is a joke. And then the other thing was that they had some very interesting policies, again, which you alerted me to. One was they partnered with local banks to do investment in the state, for business. They would, to give loans, basically, to businesses that want to expand or come into the state. But the deal was for every $100,000 they loaned, there had to be a full-time job created in the state. So that was a nice feature, and they did better. They had better services on student loans, et cetera. But
and
the thing that you taught me,
ridiculously low.
Yeah, and well, this is what you taught me was that, and I never thought about this, and I now do this every time I do a workshop or a radio show. I say, look, I'm in New Jersey. When I write a check for taxes to the state of New Jersey, where does it go? I always thought, well, there's some big vault or something, somewhere there's an account in the state of New Jersey, and that's where the money goes. But in fact, the state of New Jersey has to put its money with a large Wall Street bank that can handle their cash flow needs. So our tax dollars end up in a Wall Street bank in New Jersey, and in most of the states, I'd say all the states end up putting their money into a Wall Street bank, except North Dakota, where that money goes to help capitalize the Bank of North Dakota, which then makes a profit for the taxpayer, goes into the coffers of North Dakota. I did a little back of the envelope calculation, which is about as good as I can do, and I estimate that there's something like $1 trillion of tax funds that run through Wall Street that instead could be running through state banks if we had 50 state banks. And if it was loaned out the way the Bank of North Dakota loans it out, that would create 10 million jobs. And yeah, we wouldn't be subsidizing enormously wealthy private banks, too big to fail banks on Wall Street. The question I have for you is the one kickback, blowback I get from people is they say, oh, North Dakota, it's only successful there because of the oil boom. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I just read an article on that. You know, the Wall Street Journal came out with an article saying that the Bank of North Dakota was actually more profitable than the big Wall Street banks. And then they said, but this was because of the oil boom, that they got all these extra deposits from the state because the state was doing well. Well, the state may be doing well because of the oil boom, but I would argue, first of all, that they wouldn't be doing nearly as well if the Bank of North Dakota wasn't there to set up the infrastructure for the oil industry. But the fact that the bank is getting more deposits is not actually helping the bank. They actually take those deposits and they haven't increased their the amount of loans they're doing significantly. They're putting those extra deposits into securities the same way that the big banks do. You know, they've got this big excess deposit base now.
Mm-hmm.
And the bank is stuck with having to finance all these. They have to redo their roads to protect them for the farmers, because these are little dirt roads. They were little dirt roads, and now they have these big oil trucks driving over them all the time. So they're forced to put a lot of money into infrastructure just to keep the state viable as a farming community, you know, for doing the things they used to do. And they know that that oil booms don't last forever because they've had them before, and they know enough not to. They're not putting all their eggs in that one basket.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it looks to me like it's the other way around. That the oil boom. I mean, why is North Dakota doing better than Texas and the neighboring states that also had the Bakken oil fields? I think because they have a public bank that's funding the infrastructure that they need, hotels and all the things that they, you know, they need extra housing and so forth.
Do the bank, of North Dakota also, if a local town wants to build a school, does the bank help them with that financing, or do they have to do the usual float bonds and go to the market?
Well, they do. I know they do make direct loans for direct government loans, but I see that even North Dakota itself has issued some bonds, and I'm not sure why they do that, because it seems to me they could borrow directly from their bank and save the fees and so forth for the bond issue. But I think the bank is there for all sorts of projects like that, yeah.
Well, look, you sold me on this, because the way to stop financialization if we controlled government, we could say, yeah, we could really, really, we would have nationalized the banking industry during the crash, because it was basically bankrupt. And instead, what we did is we resurrected it. We used taxpayer guarantees and support to resurrect it. But it's very clear that the powers to be are so entwined with Wall Street that they're never going to regulate them properly. Not possible. And we can get into all the scary things that you've been writing about in terms of bail-ins instead of bail-outs, where we can lose our deposits and so on. But the way to get around this, and much harder to stop, is having a public banking movement. Because if you have 50 state banks, then you have some serious competition for Wall Street banks. For example, if the post office developed a postal bank, it has all the branches already there. First of all, the post office would be incredibly solvent. We wouldn't have to worry about, you know, crisis in financing the post office.
Well, it looks to me like they're trying to break the post office.
Of course they're trying to break it, because they want to privatize it. This goes right back to the old Better Business Climate model, which is you want to deregulate, you want to break down the public sector, you want to move money in the hands of the rich, all because you think it's going to trickle down. And what it is is it's just a scam for, you know, the wealthy influencing politicians to get more wealthy. And the post office is a place that could go either way now. It could either be crushed and then become privatized entirely, or it could become an infrastructure for a national public bank. But if we had, well, you know much better than I do, where are the next places that might get a public bank? Because I'm sure they've been talking to you. Is San Francisco
its
way?
Yeah, well, Seattle's looking good, and New Mexico. And, I mean, we're looking at Citibanks now because, well, I'm working on California, of course. But its state legislators are just almost too big. Well, certainly the state of California is almost too big. All the cities are quite approachable. The local, they know that they're broke, for one thing. One thing about states, they don't have a Federal Reserve that can print money for them like countries do. They have to, you know, they're stuck in this system where they have to borrow. So it obviously makes sense for them if we can get across to them what the point is. I mean, once they get it, once they see how much money they could save and how they all want to escape from the Wall Street. They know that there are huge fees coming down from Wall Street and there's corruption and that they've been sucked into bad bets on interest rate swaps, but they don't know how to get out of it. But anyway, so we're working on the local level right now because it seems like the most likely to break through. But you had written that no matter how much you argue, you know, make a good case from an economics perspective, you're not going to persuade the 1% to give up their benefits. So we have to have some sort of movement. I mean, we have to come at it from another angle. And it seems to me that a public banking movement, like you say, we don't need to wait for Congress to pass Glass-Steagall, which it seems to me is an uphill battle. How are they going to get these big? They just did the opposite. They just gave up. Yet, you know, the one little shred of protection they had left from the derivatives game was that 5% of the derivatives market that was covered under whatever Section 716 of the Dodd-Frank Act that they just repealed in that omnibus spending bill at the last minute in the dead of night. You know, the type of thing where nobody would have even known it was in there if Elizabeth Warren hadn't piped up and pointed out what was going on. But anyway, it seems to me that even though Glass-Steagall sounds like a good idea, I've heard some people say that it would wreak havoc. I mean, I'm not really sure what all the ramifications are. Now, it certainly was a good deal at the time, but to try and reinstate it might, you never know what these regulations do. They change everything. But the simple way to do the same thing, which is to separate our deposits from their gambling, is just don't use their banks. Just pull out and set up our own banks that are designed to be safe, secure, make safe, secure, productive loans. I mean, if people want to gamble, fine. They can go to Wall Street. If Wall Street wants to gamble, fine. But there's no reason. The only reason that we have to underwrite them is they've got all our money. Well, get your money out of there, and then, you know, problem solved.
Here's the thing I want to challenge you and other good people with, which is to, as you said it quite clearly, we're gonna need a move, a public banking movement. But I would argue we need a broad-based populist movement, of which public banking is one aspect.
Oh, yeah.
And
no, I totally
what
agree.
I'd like to see,
public banking. Right.
I'm sure you agree with this. So what I'm struggling with is figuring out a way so that the public banking movement, the low wage, you know, fast food forward, and the low, raising the minimum wage effort is connected, and the people who are concerned about police violence is connected, and the people who are involved in the other aspects of like the reverse eminent domain that's going on in various cities, that all of us should be kind of in the same room and the same movement and see the interconnectedness. Because, the rise of financialization and the rise of our prison population in this country go hand in hand. You know, for all the violence we've had in this country for, hundreds of years and all the turmoil of the 60s, the prison population was very steady. In fact, it was declining as a percent of the entire population. Now we are the number one police state in the world, not Russia, not China. We have more prisoners than any other country. And that's a result of the impoverishment and then the criminalization of low-income neighborhoods. You can bet that most of the people in prison are not wealthy. And runaway inequality.
And because of the privatization of the prison industry, it's a big business.
That feeds on it, and they want more prisoners to feed the industry. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is insane what we have going on here, and there has to be somehow we have to snap out of it. I mean, we have to understand that, you know, American exceptionalism, which we've, you know, we're the best and the greatest in the whole world. We got to wake up to the fact we have the most homeless people. We have the most children in poverty. We, you know, have the largest prison population. We have and we have the most unequal distribution of income and wealth. And the way out of this, you're leading the way in one of the most important aspects is we have to get some control over financialization and public banking. The idea of a public, of a commonwealth, as opposed to being crushed as individuals, is a way to take on Wall Street. And that's one of the ways, as well as, you know, you mentioned Seattle, the $15 an hour minimum wage. That should be the standard for the whole country. I mean, we need to put money back in the hands of, you know, the average American and get it out of the billionaires' pockets. They don't need it. That's the joke. They don't need it. They don't know what to do with it. They end up gambling with it. And then we end up picking up the tab when things screw up. And next time, as you point out, it's going to be far worse because they're not going to use tax dollars. They're going to use our dollars directly to bail out banks. Anyway, we have to construct, and I wish I was an expert on this. I wish, let's put it this way, I wish you were an expert on this as much as you were on banking, which is how do we construct a movement with staying power, not an Occupy Wall Street that disappears in 6 months, but something that can last 60 years, which is about what it will take to bring economic justice back to this country, so that we're no longer, as far as I can tell, we're the first democratic police state in the history of the world. I mean, how else do you account for the largest prison population? So we need to become a much fairer democracy that matches our ideals of the American dream. Oh, by the way, we're no longer even the most upwardly mobile country. Many European countries are more upwardly mobile than we are. So all these dreams that we've hung on to are now myths, and the myths are preventing us from moving forward. And hence, my next book is going to be to try to lay out very simply how all these things are connected.
Yeah, and it seems to me that what's going on in Russia and China, I mean, they're just moving on without us, that the BRICS are moving on without us and moving ahead with all this development. And how are they doing it? They print the money. But we won't do that because we think it's inflationary. But the reason we think that is because of bad economics. It's this whole idea of monetarism, that you've got to maintain the stability of the currency, which means you can't put any extra currency in there. Well, you've got to put extra currency. If you're going to have a growing economy, you need more money out there, and there's simply not enough. I mean, you might, if you tally it all up, you say, well, oh, there's enough. But most of that is often offshore tax havens, et cetera. It's not in the real economy. You've got to get money into the pockets of the people if you want to create the demand to create demand for products in order to stimulate business, to create jobs so people can have the money to buy the products. I mean, right now we're in this self-feeding downward spiral because we think we're broke. We're trapped in this illusion of scarcity.
How can we be broke when we're the richest country in the world?
Exactly.
We starved the public sector. We have a D as in devil, plus rating for our infrastructure. We are almost last in the world when it comes to energy efficiency. You know, we're a mess, yet we have the most billionaires, the most millionaires, and, of course, the most money parked offshore. So basically, we are becoming a third-world strip-mine nation where we're left, to basically fight over the crumbs and try to, put our roads, our schools, and the rest of our infrastructure together. I mean, today I was taking my daughter to get she'd lost her wallet, had to get her driver's license replaced. And we go to one of the centers, the motor vehicle centers here, and there is a 2.5 hour wait to do something as simple as to get your driver's license renewed.
Yeah, and
now,
then people
why is
say
that?
Government can't do anything efficiently. Well, of course they can't do anything efficiently if you don't give them the money to hire some people to do it. If you've only got two people to wait on hundreds.
We have, and I think New Jersey has the highest per capita income in the country. Of course, we could afford a decent motor vehicle. You know, we could afford it, but if wealthy people are allowed to move their money overseas and keep it there and have it accumulate tax-free, and then, of course, they find ways to use it, millions of ways. Well, that's why they have tax lawyers who work for them to do this. And the public sector, you know, you have governors like Christie who are trying to slash the public sector. Everybody's slashing the public sector. They're not going to raise taxes on the wealthy. And the wealthy hide their money overseas. I mean, this is ridiculous. At the very least, we could afford a lot more in New Jersey if we had a public bank. Oh, boy, could we afford a lot more in New Jersey if that money was going into our coffers. You know the story because you taught it to me.
Well, you know all this labor stuff, which is great, and I totally agree that we need to coordinate all these movements. I mean, the reason I focus on public banking is it seems to me that where the chokehold is on the money, that we think we don't have the money, but we could have the money. If people would understand what money is and what we've been brainwashed into believing it is, that it really isn't. In other words, that's where my focus is. If we can break the money loose, then we can do all these things that we know we need and everybody agrees should be our Bill of Rights, you know, an economic Bill of Rights. Everybody should. We shouldn't have any homeless. It's appalling that we have homeless.
No, it's ridiculous. What I want to do is, I hope before I pass away, I see a room that has the leaders and of each of the key progressive movements in this country, and I'll throw in Elizabeth Warren as well. and you know, the people who are fighting around student debt. The people who are fighting, you know, for the homeless, the people who are, trying to deal with this, you know, racial violence and so on, people doing minimum wage, public banking, okay, et cetera. Have them all in the room together and say, okay, now, how do we piece together so that we are all part of the same thing? What does it look like to piece all these movements together so that we can begin to have a common agenda? Because I know you believe, I just heard you now, you believe in all the aspects that the other groups believe in, and they believe in what you believe in. But the way we're set up is, you know, it's a big, complicated world, and we're not used to building movements. We've been relying on the Democratic Party for the last generation, which has moved steadily to the right, and except for, you know, a few, like Elizabeth Warren, Sherrod Brown, a couple of others, they are Wall Street, they are in Wall Street's pocket. They're never going to break from Wall Street. So, you know, we need a common analysis and a common movement. And I'm going to harp on that for as long as I can because I don't see much changing without it.
It is a tricky thing because we don't want to do violence. I mean, we'll lose.
No, I don't, we don't need violence at all.
To the streets. Yeah.
We don't need violence at all. We need to take to the streets. We need an agenda. We need organization is what we need. See, that's what's missing. We need organization that goes beyond, our titular, you know, environmental movement, by the way, has got to be part of this as well. They seem to think that they can run a solo battle. They can't. Wall Street is not going to, the rise in CO2 emissions, it's accelerated since financialization has taken place. You know, when you offshore a company to a nation that has no regulations, you're going to have more problems. You're just exporting the pollution. You're not solving the problem. So we have to figure out how to come together. No, violence is ridiculous. You're not going to all you do is get a backlash. But a common agenda that speaks to the American people, that actually expresses what they want, what kind of world that they really want themselves and their children to live in, I think that would have enormous success. Will we get a majority right away? No. But if we had 20-30%, we could really make a difference.
Well, but what I mean is, even though we're not violent, it seems to me if you have masses of people going out into the street, they're going to treat it as violence, and we're going to see a lot of pain happening. I mean,
you know, I just can't.
Tasering.
That's always the knock against, putting. Yes, that always can happen, but if we're well organized, we can figure out how to express our power. The problem is we're not organized, and that's why people sort of take to the streets and maybe do things in excess because they have no way, no other form of expression, because we're so unorganized. We have no political expression. There's no alternative political party. There's no agenda. So I think it's actually up to the leadership of these various movements to come together, and then we'll see what a movement looks like. When things are organized, I wouldn't worry so much about things being out of control. I think they're more out of control when we're not organized. Hey, yeah. I'd love to see a million people come to the streets and support public banking. I would think I died and went to heaven if I saw you on a platform addressing, 200,000 people in Washington about public banking. Then if there's some skirmishes on the side, so be it. The thought of you being able to put your agenda forward, I think, would make us all smile.
I do have a question on what you were saying earlier. Why was it in 1980 that things got deregulated? How did they get the power to do that? What was the tipping point?
I think for those of us who were around then, the late 60s and 70s, early 70s especially, were very turbulent. The economy overheated as a result of the Vietnam War, which a lot of the expenditures were hidden, were off the books, and that was one thing that was going on. And basically, the currency got inflated. The whole international monetary system was based on the dollar gold standard. That couldn't function well anymore. And then on top of all that chaos, you had a political economic strike through the first two Arab oil boycotts that sent commodity prices through the roof, because they quadrupled the price of oil, in part to make up from American inflation. And what you had was, first you had, for the first time, I think, virtually ever in the American economy, you had severe inflation that set in, to the point where Nixon instituted wage and price controls. And then you had, to cope with the inflation, that led to unemployment, and you had this combination which we called stagflation. You had unemployment and inflation running side by side. And that's when conservative economists said, see, Keynes was wrong. You can't have the government fine-tune the economy. It doesn't work. What you need to do is get the government out of the economy. About 12% of corporations were pretty tightly controlled by, the telephone industry was controlled, the airline was controlled, trucking was controlled. All that was thrown out the window and with the hope that, increased competition, lack of, less regulation, et cetera, would turn the economy around. But in the process, and here's the joke, while they were aiming to deregulate the private sector, the piece that they really deregulated, that they didn't even pay any attention to, was finance. And finance was something that we had learned during the Depression cannot be deregulated. When you deregulate finance, you are going to get a crash. We had our foot on the neck of Wall Street from 1933 all the way to basically the late 1970s. And as a result of that tight grip, there were no financial crises anywhere except Brazil in 1965. Once we deregulated, you know how many financial crises there have been around the world since we deregulated finance? Over 180.
Wow. And so what were the actual regulations that were first repealed?
Well, the first thing they did was they decontrolled the savings and loan industry, which was falling, and that led to literally the pillaging of the savings and loan industry and 1,000 savings and loan corporations crashed to the tune of $180 billion in bailouts. And on top of that, I believe it was roughly 1,000 executives
were thrown in jail.
Convicted. None got convicted this time. 1,000 got convicted that time. So that was one big piece. The other piece was that every attempt, it became obvious that. By the way, when a corporate raider buys up a company and loads it up with debt, then the company is no longer. Instead of paying taxes on its profits in a sense get reduced, and debt becomes a deduction. Right? When you pay interest on debt, it's a deduction. So it was cutting into taxes. And Dan Rastankowski from Chicago was head of, I think, Ways and Means at the time, or Finance Committee, said, hey, what are you doing? We're letting these guys take money out of our public treasury by loading up a company with debt. We should put a cap saying, once you put more than $500,000 of debt on. You're going to pay, the interest payments are not going to be deductible. And they went after him tooth and nail. Even that kind of similar small regulation was thrown out the window. So it started with savings and loans, and then mergers were allowed, even before Glass-Steagall. Companies, investment banks were getting, you know, insurance, investment banks were starting to, you know, overlap, and things were getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Financial institutions were getting, you know, huge. And the argument was, you got to deregulate us so we can compete around the world. You know, America's banks have to be number one and so on. So there were, you know, there were a bunch of baby steps. And then the big steps happened actually during the Clinton administration. Took a Democratic administration to basically put all derivatives off limits, get rid of Glass-Steagall, which already had been watered down. And now you had, you know, you basically had a deregulated financial industry. Also, by the way, you had someone like Greenspan who believed that, and this was part of the economic theory, which was that the private sector polices itself, so you don't need to have regulations. So he, you know, when predatory lending was going on, he turned a blind eye, said, "Nah, don't worry, this will all work out. I'm not going to, we're not going to use the Federal Reserve to regulate the banking community," and you know, he just let it do its thing, and its thing ultimately became exactly the same as in the 1920s. Sooner or later, you get a horrendous crash, and we got one.
Well, trying to think of a positive note to end on. I think we've come to the end of our time, but it's been really great talking to you, and I think we should work more on this idea of a common movement among all these groups. That's what we really need to focus on, is how we can mobilize everyone. It seems to me that one way that they maintain their power is to pit all these little groups against each other. Well, particularly, obviously, Democrats and Republicans are pitted together on little issues that aren't really the real issues, while they get away with murdering the larger issues. So somehow we have to come together. And I love your work on the whole labor issue. So,
well, hey, look, I think you're an inspiration to us all, because you're taking on the big boys directly, and you know what they're doing in quite detail. And we need that. We need your leadership on public banking, and I just hope that you're able to your voice is heard loud and far. And I think, you know, look, if it inspired me, it's going to inspire others.
Yeah, thanks, Les. Well, it's been great talking to you.
Same here.
I've been speaking with Les Leopold, the director of the Labor Institute and the author of How to Make $1 Million an Hour, Why Hedge Funds Get Away with Siphoning Off America's Wealth.
On the Public Banking Report today, we talk about a larger concern about whether the ability for American cities, counties, and states to create public banks of their own could be curtailed if the impending Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty gets approved. The TPP is a secretive, corporate-designed policy shift that would give significant new rights to corporations to take dominant control over specific aspects of marketplace operations. Our guest Kevin Zeis likes to call the TPP a rigged trade agreement instead of a free trade agreement. Kevin is a noted activist and attorney who's helped lead public issue campaigns via his popular Clearing the Fog radio show and their website popularresistance.org. The Trans-Pacific Partnership idea has been under secretive development for a couple years and would impose significant international corporate rights that override local laws to remain open for international marketers regardless of local labor and environmental protection. Despite the strong arms of corporate lobbyists, Zeis is still optimistic about the chances to stop it.
We think we can still stop it. And the reason we think we can stop it is because really there's opposition on both sides of the political aisle. I think this last omnibus bill angered a lot of the Democrats at President Obama. On the Republican side, you know, we have a mix of arguments that support us. One is that the constitutional role of the Congress is to be the regulator of trade. And so the fast track would undo that. And so people who believe in the Constitution will oppose it. In addition, people don't like the idea of giving President Obama more power. Now, there's a strong opposition to his policies on the Republican side. We think we can use that to our advantage. And finally, there's this question of sovereignty. The TPP will undermine national sovereignty, and to do that in an undemocratic way, I think a lot of Republicans will oppose. I think we have a good chance of bipartisan opposition in the House.
Now, this is being pushed so heavily by corporate interests, though. Do you not feel that the corporate hand is going to be strong enough to push these guys to vote the way they want?
Well, that's definitely the battle. It's going to be corporate power versus people power. I mean, we have a lot of corporate Democrats and obviously a lot of corporate Republicans, and that's the bipartisan team that they're trying to put together, and we're trying to put together enough to stop that. It's going to be a close vote. It'll probably be a vote, you know, of less than 10-vote majority either way, and so it's going to be a big fight.
And Kevin emphasizes how important this fight will be to public interest.
The TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and the Transatlantic version affect every aspect of our lives, whether it's banking reform, whether it's extreme energy extraction, fracking, tar sands, pipelines, wealth divide. The wealth divide will be made worse by this. Labor rights, environmental rights, all this stuff, internet freedom, everything. Our food and water is affected by this. We can really create a movement of movements to push back.
How does the TPP impact these areas? What does it set up?
Well, first of all, it's been negotiated now for all of Obama's presidency. It actually started during Bush, but he didn't do much with it. Obama's been the one negotiating it. They've negotiated in secret now for his whole time in office, except for 600 corporate advisors. And 600 corporate advisors are people that, like Halliburton and Monsanto, the big banks, all the corporations that we are in constant conflict with. And they've been able to see the text live and make changes, add a comma here, take out a clause, add a paragraph, add a section, take out a section. So they've totally written this for their benefit. And the leaks that we've seen have shown that these drafts that they're talking about have less environmental protection than even Bush-era trade agreements had. There's no environmental enforcement at all. And the real power in this is trade tribunals that allow for corporations to sue governments when a law passed in the public interest for workers or for environmental protection or internet freedom. They can then sue the government for the expected profits, not just real profits, but profits they expected to get before that law was passed. And then it makes it worse, though, is it goes before a trade tribunal, three judges, most of them will be corporate lawyers, on leave from their corporate job, do their judge thing, then go back to their corporate job, and there's no appeal to a real court. So it's the final decision. These three corporate lawyers, as the judges, will decide the final decision. So it's a rigged system of tribunal that can undermine the sovereignty of the United States even. And that's why conservatives will oppose it, because, sovereignty of the country, I think even corporate power is going too far when they do that kind of thing.
Well, now, in a specific instance, let's say banking, does that in any way set up a category of possible challenge to this agreement?
Yeah, one thing about these trade agreements is they really do not like state-supported enterprises. They really want things privatized and put into a commodity where corporations can profit. And so the banking industry will see a public bank as a state-supported enterprise and be able to challenge that. We could even see some very strong public institutions like Medicare disappear because of this trade agreement. I mean, the antipathy to state-supported enterprises runs through this whole thing. And what you have to remember about these agreements is when they are passed, we have to harmonize our laws and regulations with the agreement. One reason we lost the separation between investment banks and traditional banks in the 1990s was because the WTO required us to lose that. And so as we had to harmonize Clinton had to harmonize our laws with that agreement. And so that's going to be the thing that's going to be a real shocker to the system, is how many laws are forced to change in order to be consistent with the TPP and the Atlantic TAFTA agreement. Corporate power gets a lot done through the back door with these laws. Things that even our very corrupt corporate Congress, there's the bidding of the corporations, won't pass everything they want. And these trade agreements enable them to pass things behind the door, secretly negotiated. For the first time ever, these agreements are classified. Even if a Congress member is able to see them, which is rare, they're not allowed to discuss it, not allowed to take any notes, not allowed to bring their computer in the room, not allowed to bring their phone in the room, they can't bring any staff, and then they're not allowed to talk about it because it's classified. And then you have fast track, which would mean that Congress has no real review. Under fast track, this is the only way they can pass these laws, is fast track. Without fast track, these laws will fail. Fast track requires Congress to make a decision within 30 days in the House, 60 days in the Senate, no amendments, and a limited amount of hearings on the floor, and they have to decide up or down in that rapid time. This will be a treaty that's well more than 1,000 pages long, and they'll have this minimum amount of time to debate it, with no amendments. And so it totally destroys congressional responsibility in the Constitution.
Has there been a previous instance where fast track has been approved?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and we got NAFTA because of fast track. There's been a lot of trade agreements that have passed without fast track, but those are not these mega trade agreements like NAFTA. And this agreement's way beyond a trade agreement. It really is a corporate power agreement. I hate when people call it free trade because it's not anything like free. It's rigged trade for transnational corporations. It undermines small businesses, medium-sized businesses, startups, citizen activity. It's not really free trade. This is rigged trade for transnational corporations. It's about the most crony capitalist approach to the economy you can imagine. And so fast track is essential to pass this kind of treaty. Well, because if the people know what's in it, they'll oppose it. So that's the whole point, is to keep it secret in the negotiation and not have any real debate in Congress.
So the next procedural step is that when a new Congress comes back, it's going to be submitted as a request for the fast-track approval.
What will happen next is in both houses of Congress, supporters of fast-track will introduce legislation, and groups like ours, Popular Resistance, which is popularresistance.org, and our campaign against the TPP is called flushthetpp.org. People can go to either one of those sites and sign up to get involved in helping to fight these. Once those bills are introduced, then it'll go through the process of Congress to consider them. And that is when the citizens need to organize and mobilize and really let members of Congress know. We'll be doing a lot of different activities to highlight it, including civil resistance type efforts, as well as traditional lobbying. There's a great network of people already working on this. There's a website called Stop Fast Track that brings together a lot of organizations, including ours, to oppose it. And we have to get those folks excited and energized to really stop this. I really do think we can stop it. And if we do stop it, it's a tremendous victory of people over transnational corporate power. And that's a victory we can really build on. If we fail to stop it, it shows that the work we have to do to build the movement we need. It also will set back almost every effort we're working on. And so it'll be a big challenge if we lose it.
How noticeable is the hand of the global bankers in this?
This is really the transnational corporate power. That's what this is about. And the bankers, of course, invest in all of that. So there's no question that the international banks are very much behind this. It will weaken a lot of the already too weak regulation of the big banks. It'll make it very hard to control capital inflows and outflows in countries. It'll allow banks a lot of freedom to leave a country very quickly. And not just banks, but any corporation. And so it's really going to make it very hard for governments to control their economy and control their cash flows. So you can definitely see that a lot of the provisions in here would be things that the banks want. And so it's pretty obvious that they're right, making a big push.
That's Kevin Zeese of PopularResistance.org and FlushTheTPP.org. That's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, brought to you with support from Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services, dedicated to the cause of economic justice and fairness and to the creation of new American public banks. Visit them at paymentmgmt.com to request a complimentary analysis of your current card processing expenses. Be sure to follow Ellen Brown's commentary and the blog discussions, which are really quite invigorating and informative, by going to ellenbrown.com. And you can hear previous editions of this program through podcast by going to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown at prn.fm. Our thanks to Payment Management, our guests, prn.fm, and to you for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Money!